Welcome to the Poetry Bath with me, Sian Thomas. This is the second instalment of my interview with Rebecca Tomash. And in this episode, Rebecca continues to read from and talk about her collection, Witch. We were a little bit pressed for time, but I hope you enjoy the show. Rebecca Tomash, welcome back to the Poetry Bath once again for the second episode. We were just talking about how even though Witch as a collection took a long time to write, and the editing process and so on, but also writing the initial poems, particularly the spell poems, in a kind of frenzy, a delicious frenzy by the sounds of things, to some extent, helped. And I wonder if we can sort of go on from that to the idea of anger as well. You talked about anger. And is there anything, do you have a poem that speaks to that further?
I mean, I think that probably the angriest poem in the collection is the one that I shared in the last episode, Penis Hex. So that's a poem which obviously, yes, it's driven by a fair bit of anger. Perhaps there is another poem where there is a huge amount of anger is Witch Trials. I should just say it's long. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Do it.
Okay. For sure. And then yes, it's without a doubt probably the most relevant to the question of anger in terms of what we're thinking about. And it's perhaps interesting context that, again, for those of your listeners who haven't read the book, you might imagine that this is a book in which there is kind of lots of material about the European witch trials, because of course it is drawing on that event and it's drawing on the kind of thinking and sort of feminist practice around how that happened and why that happened. But actually in the book there isn't a huge amount of my material that directly engages with it. This poem I'm about to read is the most kind of close connection to those specific events in the book. Okay. And it's called Witch Trials. What happens at the witch's sabbat is a bunch of women sit together, lock fingers together and say things. Sometimes they sing, sometimes they tell each other secrets or make plans. The wind rubs away their voices, they sneak them back, stars cough. This is what it's like to turn over to the devil, so much smoke, so much strange movement. The witch has familiars. She has a wolf, a dog, a sparrow, a grey cat, a horse, a delicate toad, a shivering goat. Why on earth would you not kiss those slim blue tongues? Why would you not slip into the night with them? How it feels to feed a wolf is how it feels to know things, the impossible sharpness of reality. When the devil came back, the witch started asking him about God, even if it was a somewhat awkward subject. She wanted to know why she occasionally turned up at church and sat alone on the end stool, feeling bored and sick, and all the stones seemed to say, "You are not alive, you are not alive, you are not alive." The devil pushed his hair up into a butterfly clip, sighed and said, "It's buried, there's just this space." And the witch said, "Tell me about the space. Tell me what would happen if I could touch God and lick his marble face. Tell me what would occur if I was let down there to find him. It's been so long." And the devil said, "You don't want that, but it would be something like black, 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 grey, black, 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 pink." The witch tries to think about how it started. Maybe it was when a girl came home late at night with half her clothes missing. Maybe it was when her lovable nickname became Slut, when everyone called her Slut so much that even the witch thought of her as the Slut, even as she cried about it, she cried about the Slut. Maybe it was when the witch made beds in the cellar for everyone coming to abort their unwanted babies, and she burned herbs to get rid of the smell of shit and blood. And women went home dazed and elated and horrified by themselves, by their strange lightness. Maybe it was when she saw a woman spend every day walking from her house to the top of the hill and back again, over and over, never actually stopping. Her face was sooty and her mac had rips in it. She kept walking and walking at top speed, and the witch wanted to say, "Please stop," or "Where are you going?" But fucking hell, of course she knew exactly where she was going. Maybe it was when she put on that scratchy halter. Maybe it was when someone knocked a fence up and her and the cow just looked at each other blindly. Maybe it was when corpses went in the river. Maybe it was when the books peeled off. Maybe it was when everyone started to look down at the floor rather than catching each other's eyes. Maybe it was when the town board took a financial stake in sexual services. Maybe it was when they kept saying, "Walk, don't run," and her legs ached with green splintered clashing. Maybe it was when bats fled the church at weddings. Maybe it was when there was this punishment. Maybe it was when her friends started to say, "Hit me, please hit me, please hit me, hit me, hit me, hit me, hit me." And when she got hit, it made her come. The witch wanted to run away, but where is a way? They were using her name like a flag. Hands were black with smoke. When they touched you, it was a touch that pulls internal organs, dirty shapes amongst the viscera. Night can start at daybreak, that was clear. Night when you pray and pray for morning and listen out for a bird's minute watery cry, and it doesn't come. The witch could only think of it in squares, one small image at a time, a sip of it. Men standing, cage, floor, foot twisting like a shot hare, ink leaking from a bit of paper. The witch wanted to organize dances that would heat the room to such an extent that all of it would be sweated out. All the humanness would bleed into furry salt and slick pouring. The witch wanted to cut throats, break and break and break and break and break. See what her hand would look like ripped from its mooring. Hate is this blue gob of spit. It is pushing open a chap mouth and spitting into it. The witch thought once in this square there were dinosaurs, and before that there were these fish who began rubbing their fins on the sand. They wanted to come up and breathe and walk around. There were fish people come out of the sea, gasping and coughing, building small shelters out of pines. At some point, one of them will have put an arm around another one. At some point, one will have started singing. The witch begged to the air, "When did this? What is this?" The ash stuck to everything. It became everything and ran down the houses, down people's faces, down window panes and chicken coops and sheds and workshops and front steps and bed sheets and cardboard boxes, tight, sticky little collar around every cell. The ash got into the atmosphere and changed the weather systems. Hail became more regular. Asthma was an issue. Rain didn't dig out light but brought a choked distance. Dogs were eating their young and leaving the half-chewed bits on the pavement. They know something, thought the witch. The witch didn't record how many people were called witches or who died, who condemned them or who reported them, who tried to hide, who went quite bravely to the flames, who screamed up to the edge of sound when they were dying, who was quiet or how many children wandered around the mess, what level of society the average victim came from. What happened to bone marrow in the heat? Which people were sent mad by events and started to beg for themselves to be killed too? Who remained seemingly unaffected? What happened to the excess of blood that someone had to collect? To the individual teeth, the gold jewelry, the ornate rings, the balled up sanitary pads, the false eyes rolling fondly, the slick waste from intestinal breakdown, the song that she was singing that ended up in heads, corpse words. The road was narrow, but my lover, he fought on. In live heads, worming and writhing, the lack of crying at funerals, the boy dragging his filthy dog into the square because he knew that it was the devil incarnate, that it had killed his mother, his sister, that it made him touch his own cock and moan for something, that if he could push it up into the fire too, then probably all of this would end. Someone licking at a dark patch on the ground, like it was the most tender spot of something beloved. Instead, the witch spent the whole time forcing her eyes to stay open, even when the air was very thick. She was going to keep having a look, even if it took every piece of eye meat. She would develop night vision for this long night.
whole world in that poem. You've included all of us, and it's just all creatures, great and small. I wondered whether you could just talk about, we talked briefly about, I mean, there's so much in that poem. There's apps, it's absolutely, but we can just talk briefly then about climate chaos. There are references to environmental catastrophe in that.
Yeah, it feeds into it. I mean, this is very much what I'm still thinking about. And my kind of next book is sort of even more directly kind of ecologically focused, certainly in significant parts of it. But I think with this book, the kind of the connection was obviously kind of multi-layered, but I think it's that really important recognition, I suppose, that kind of the fate of the non-human world and the fate of human beings who are minoritized in some way. So, in this case, I'm thinking about women, but obviously that's true of people from like, a variety of minoritized backgrounds in the West, that it's not just that those people suffer from climate crisis, though of course they do. It's that that oppression is kind of wholly interlinked. And I think recognition of that is so powerful. I mean, this is, slightly away from my actual book, but there's an amazing book by Catherine Yusof called A Billion Black Anthropocenes or None, I believe is the title. I might be getting that wrong. But she talks about the idea that actually the kind of climate crisis didn't start with the Industrial Revolution. It started with the Atlantic slave trade, which created the wealth which brought about the Industrial Revolution. I mean, that's a huge simplification of her amazing work, but that's one of the central ideas. And I think part of what I'm sort of thinking about or trying to think about in the poem is, yes, of course, the connection between kind of oppression of nature and oppression of women has often been connected, because often women are kind of seen as being more of nature, therefore kind of more primal, but also more kind of dangerous and so forth. And that's absolutely true. But also that's often seen as something kind of purely metaphorical or purely symbolic. But obviously, actually, it's also just to do with, as you've talked about, this fear of irrationality, this fear of mystery, this fear of unknowing, which is kind of such a fear of the kind of patriarchal, Western machine. And so I think it's not just about symbolism. I think it's about a real danger that actually people who are more connected through kind of cultural practice to mystery and irrationality have. And I think the kind of powerful world is afraid of that. And so I think that's kind of part of what I was trying to try together in that poem, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think it really does. And it's really interesting to hear that you're working on it further in your new work as well. And do you I that sounds also like a very difficult path to tread as well. Because of course then you have the danger of speaking for people.
In terms of writing about the environment, or
Absolutely.
absolutely, or speaking for nature, I suppose. Absolutely. I mean, I think, I suppose possibly just because of the nature of the kind of writing I do, it's quite embedded into my thinking, and kind of the nature poets or the environmental poets and, writers who I admire are all people who sort of really actively seek to always plot out that distance between the human and the non-human, so that even if you're writing something very kind of emotive about the climate crisis, I mean, I'm not saying I'm necessarily doing that, but even if you are doing that, I think it's still perfectly possible to kind of draw that distance between you and nature, and to never try and kind of voice it, but just to respond to it and kind of think around it. And actually, though he's not really considered a kind of particularly environmental poet, one of my kind of major inspirations for this is actually Wallace Stevens, who I think is a very philosophical poet, but is really interested, I think, in the philosophy of thinking around the world that isn't human, and how you actually show in poetic language that you're almost respecting that independence and autonomy and agency. And I think you also see it in poets like Mae Mae Bersenbrugger, And also actually Jen Hadfield, all extremely different poets, but I think that they all leave that space. And I think if you are writing, environmental poetry in the 21st century, you have to do that because, as you say, yeah, you certainly don't want to be kind of voicing or ventriloquizing others' experience, whether it's other people or other beings.
Do you find that which has that you've drawn on which your practice in which to feed into the new work?
Interesting. Probably not in a conscious way, because of course it's you kind of just have ongoing relationships. Your writing doesn't have, just because it's been published in a book, obviously there's not such kind of hard demarcation lines. But I think the way in which my practice has really carried on is that I suppose, which was my first kind of full-length book of poetry, and I suppose I kind of thought, this is a standalone thing, and I'll probably never write anything like this before, which in some ways is true. But I think what I have realized is I'm definitely a project poet. I'm not someone who's going to create a book of 60 poems, each of which are totally not linked, which I wrote at different times with different ideas. I really admire and I'm in awe actually of poets that have that many ideas, but that's not me. So that the sort of center of my next book is one very long poem. There are other pieces in it as well. It's a mixture, but I think for me, sort of having that relationship with a character, even if it's imagined in my poetry, for whatever reason, I do just find it to be generative. So for me, being able to work with character and work also on a kind of bigger scale, so across multiple poems, I found that to be a version of practice that I honed with which and which I'm carrying on, and I find really, yeah, just interesting and enjoyable to play with.
Do you find that fiction has fed into that as well? Are you a lover of novels too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, unsurprisingly, I'm a lover of all forms of writing,
Bit of a
basically.
stupid question, really,
No,
isn't
not at all. But I
it?
mean, it's interesting because I absolutely, I absolutely love reading fiction. I very much keep up with contemporary fiction as well. I'm very, very interested in kind of what's being published, and I really engage with that. So of course, it's there, it's filtered in, though interestingly for me, I suppose, I have absolutely no sort of desire to write fiction. I mean, I once gave it a go and it was a bit of a car crash, something only my literary agent has ever seen. I'm not saying everything in it was terrible, but narrative and plot and characters is just like a version of hell to me. Because I just find it impossible. But I mean, obviously, I also have a creative nonfiction practice, so I really enjoy working with prose, but just not through a fictional lens for whatever reason. It's a little bit too, I think it demands too much clarity. And of course, fans of extremely experimental work will say, well, that's not true. And of course, it doesn't have to be. But for whatever reason, I feel that demand when I try and write fiction, so it's not for me.
Right, the kind of the narrative arc.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. It's really interesting, isn't it? I've been thinking a lot about this and talking with friends a lot about this recently. And I went to see Dear England, not in the theatre, but one of those wonderful live stream showings in the local cinema. And oh my goodness, just the absolute joy of a beautifully told story that's full of heart. And I sat there thinking, God, I want to eat this. I want to eat
I
this.
know that feeling.
Yeah, and but also but to channel it into poetry.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I mean, yeah, it's funny. I mean, obviously, that feeling of wanting to eat a good story, I know exactly what you mean. Over Christmas, I finished Little Dorrit, the Charles Dickens. Great example of that. One of the pleasures, in a way, I suppose, for me, reading fiction is the freedom from my own practice. Of course, it feeds into it, but I don't have to sort of think, oh, could I do this? So I can just enjoy it. But it's interesting you mentioned theatre because I love theatre, and that is a real interest of mine. I once had mad dreams to be a director, which I gave up as soon as I had a go, because that really was hell. I mean, I joke about fiction, but I couldn't be more ill-suited to directing and kind of having to actually to create in front of people. That's what directing is. You have to create, but everyone's watching, which is the poet's worst nightmare. But I certainly think that some of the kind of narrative influence that you see in my poetry comes from theatre, and I'm very interested in ritual. And obviously, if you think about the kind of beginnings of poetry or oral storytelling and so forth, to me, sometimes there's more of a kind of cousinship between poetry and theatre than there is between poetry and fiction. And so I think that's also in there, that sense of kind of voice rather than plot. Of course, many plays have great plots, but yeah, that kind of sense of direct communication, and sort of the power of that speaking forward and speaking back. Yeah, I just find really fascinating. I try not to overthink it too much, but it's in there.
That's gorgeous. I mean, you're just making me want to go and write reams.
That's good. That's good. You should.
great feeling. Could you give us another poem? Then I want to ask, because we've now got 6 minutes left. So if you could give us another poem, please, Rebecca. And then I want to ask you about compassion and the devil,
Sure.
finally.
Okay, great. Yes. Well, in that case, maybe I'll read a short one. Again, for those of you who haven't read the book, not all the poems have mentions of penises, just some of them. Okay. Spell for emotions. Make a cake that looks like a picture of your mother making a cake. Set up an industrial skyline with more and more tender phalluses hitting the air. Don't you realize how little time there is? You can't set up a portfolio or reason about the amount of passengers through the border. You have to stop crying or whatever. You have to cup a breast just there in the suggestive lamplight, or put your mouth on a fox's mouth, though it hurts and hurts, or carry a person on your back over a revered mountain. You have to hurry, 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 hurry.
And now, of course, I'm seeing it entirely as a monologue, that piece. I now see a black stage with a single spotlight, which would work beautifully, wouldn't it?
It would pretend, yeah. I mean, gosh, obviously, I never want to sort of step on the toes of real theatre, but there's certainly a theatrical element. And actually, amazing composer Freya Whaley-Cohen has done an adaptation of some of the Spell poems into opera. And the performative aspect of seeing that, they recently had a performance at the Barbican, was incredible. So the theatrical element is without a doubt there, and she tapped into it. But yes, whether it, something for other practitioners to think about.
So tell us, please, before we finish, about the figure of the devil. And because I notice in your collection that he is, oh, there was so much kindness, often between him and the witch, and the witch and other women. And so, yeah, tell me about the devil and yeah.
Yeah, the devil's a really important character to me in the book, and I think part of what the devil represents, well, there's so many elements. I mean, partly, the devil is a kind of gender non-conforming character, so also really important that kind of, the freedom of women is the freedom to push against gender and escape gender rather than kind of reify and rigidify it. But also, the devil and the witch have an extremely loving relationship. It's not always easy, but it's one which kind of does absolutely flow out of empathy and kindness. And, for me, in a way, the devil, I suppose, is a character who's kind of born out of that alternative sort of way of interpreting the Christian story, which is, if you're thinking about the apple and Eve, for example, the apple is knowledge, and you can see that as a terrible fall, or you can see that as the kind of beginning of everything that's good about the human story in terms of engaging with the wider world and having kind of intellectual and emotional and bodily freedom. And so the devil is that. The devil is the opposite of rigidity, the opposite of simplicity. That's of course partly why they could never be kept in some kind of strict gender binary, obviously, because they transcend that. And that sense that the witch obviously in a way transcends time, but she still begins as a character from the period of the witch trials, a period in which, obviously the Christian story was told in a very misogynistic way. And I think part of what the devil is almost her being able to connect to a version of transcendence and a version of spirituality and mysticism, which is generative and which is beautiful and which is kind rather than sinful and punishing. So I think, yeah, that's kind of their story.
It's glorious. Do you have a short poem that with the devil and those ideas? I know you have a number of poems where the devil's non-binary nature is really comes across, and you
Yeah, I
play
mean,
with that idea.
I'm sorry that I don't have any short ones at all. They're all extremely long. I mean, I could give you a little section from Interrogation where she talks about the devil.
Please,
Yeah,
yeah, if
that's
you
probably
could.
the only thing I could kind of extract. Okay. So this is an extract from Interrogation. Are you a witch? Are you? Have you had relations with the devil? Have you? Have you had relations with the devil and what took place? I kissed him under the tail. It was a bit like soil, a bit like road tar when it heats up. He was flickering in pleasure. The field would be just the same when I tongue that, the bird's feathers parting. What knowledge did the devil give you? I built a house next to the sea. The roof is red orange. The sky is a shaking plate of light peeling you back. There is grass out the front, some metal bins. You can see a lighthouse. I began to sleep with the windows open. I began to creep along the bed to my own globe face in the mirror. Sitting rubbed up in myself is this fierce fire. It does not come from me. Even the stones in the drive are crackling with it. What did the devil make you do under his control? His mother had just died. We ate mint ice cream by the coffin. He was missing her. My sock was loose. We kept laughing.
So adorable. Well, we have run out of time. Rebecca Tomash, it has been an absolute delight. Thank you so very much for joining me in the Poetry Bar.
Thank you so much, Sean. It's been a total pleasure talking to you and really appreciate all of your sort of depth of thinking around the poems.
Been listening to the Poetry Bath with me, Sian Thomas, and my guest, Rebecca Tomash. Our theme tune was composed and performed by Nigel Horn, and do join me once again next time for more poetry and conversation. Thanks for listening. Bye.